So we poked along back home, said Huckleberry Finn. And I weren't feeling so brash as I was before, but kind of ornery and humble and to blame somehow, though I hadn't done nothing. But that's always the way. It don't make no difference whether you do right or wrong. A person's conscience ain't got no sense. It just goes for them anyway. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, Director of Distance Learning at Wyoming Catholic College, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar podcast. December 15th is Bill of Rights Day, and when I asked political philosopher Dr. Virginia Arbery if she'd be willing to talk to us about the Bill of Rights, she said she'd be happy to talk about rights. But rather than the Bill of Rights, she suggested we discuss Mark Twain's novel, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Twain's story about the friendship and travels of Huck, a runaway boy, and Jim, a runaway slave, explores right and wrong, freedom and bondage, conscience rightly formed and conscience poorly formed, rights and responsibilities. Written in the 1880s after the Civil War and Reconstruction, the tale is set in the 1840s, in the days of slavery, and it begins in Missouri, the slave state side of the famous Missouri Compromise. Dr. Arbery, while the Civil War and Reconstruction were over, slavery was abolished, the blacks were all free, here we are in the 1880s, there's nonetheless a rather calcified attitude toward blacks across the country. What were those attitudes and how was Twain trying to address them?
Well, we see, as we know from so many of the recent controversies over removing monuments in the South, we see that there was a period of a resurgence of interest in asserting the cause of the Confederacy. At first, Lee had tried very hard to bring about reconciliation, reunion, always played down any of the fellow Southerners whom he loved, but who approached him about starting the war again. And he refused that role. So, but around him was going on this keen interest in bringing some of the more divisive issues to the foreground. And of course, we know that for at least 40 years, as Lincoln reminds us in the 40s with his Lyceum address, that mob violence is a terrible problem. And it continues all through the 70s and 80s with the resurgence of lynchings after the war. I think that Twain, in having scene after scene of mob violence in his great Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, is addressing both that lawlessness and also the residual anti-black, anti-free Negro that had emerged as a result of Lincoln's intervention.
Well, while Huck was staying with the feuding Grangerfield family, he goes to church with them, and at the end he comments, "It was pretty ornery preaching, all about brotherly love and such tiresomeness." Well, in addition to the irony, of course, of the feuding families thinking the sermon on brotherly love is just great, we have Huck's, and in that we have Twain's anti-church, anti-Christian, anti-Bible kind of take on life. And yet Huck is an example of brotherly love and such tiresomeness, if anyone is. So tell us about Huck's, what we might call Huck's moral imagination.
Yes, I think that's an excellent term. Many great scholars such as T.S. Eliot, Toni Morrison, the great African-American novelist who won the Nobel Prize in Literature, these two, among others, have studied the conflict between what the young man thinks of as directing his conscience and what is directing his heart. And his moral imagination is more in his heart than it is in his head. At several junctions in the novel, most particularly when he tears up a letter that he is going to write Miss Watson, the owner of the runaway slave, Jim, at several junctions he struggles with his conscience and then decides it's just of no use. It takes up more room than anything and is of no help, he says. But his conscience is formed by the civil views, society's views by convention, but his heart is informed by a man whom he sees as a friend, at some junctions even a kind of father, someone who, though he still thinks of him as property, also thinks of him as fully a human and a very splendid human being.
And in that, could you say that Huck is sort of a natural rights philosopher?
You know, I just finished discussing this novel with our wonderful seniors here at Wyoming Catholic, and that's what we concluded. We use the term natural law thinker because natural rights is so confused with modern social contract theorists, but I think in a very optimistic sense, the young man is seeing that sense of justice in his world, wherever he goes down the Mississippi, is faulty, but that friendship is a greater ethical good than the justice which he sees imposed through civil authority. So he asserts that friendship strongly. And interestingly, a figure who doesn't seem to get the best press among the critics, Tom Sawyer, his old friend from back home who shows up towards the end of the novel, also provides a situation which stages Jim not only as a human being, but as a kind of aristocrat. And that's an interesting turn in the novel as well.
Tell us about that. And I mean, at one point, Jim is dressed up as King Lear. I mean, he's dressed up as royalty.
Yes. So that's the first time that we see him in that, with that association of royalty. And it happens after a very intimate moment on the raft, after Jim has stayed up for Huck during their late night, what you call vigils on the raft, so that no one catches Jim. And Jim is thinking and despairing over something he's done, and he keeps talking about his children. And that night then Huck learns from Jim that he, Jim, had struck his little girl who wouldn't shut the door when he told her to, and comes to realize that the reason she hadn't shut it, that she kept disobeying him, was that she couldn't hear, that she had lost her hearing from scarlet fever. And that very next scene, after Jim says he can never forgive himself for what he did to his little Elizabeth, he's dressed as Lear, who can never forgive himself for what he did to Cordelia. And he's dressed as Lear because one of the shysters who've taken over the raft wants to be able to travel during the days. All right, so that's the first scene. And then the other that you've asked me about, of course, is when Tom surprises everyone and arrives into the action again towards the end of the novel. And Jim is already incarcerated on the farm where Tom and Huck find themselves. And instead of just going back on the raft and getting on the water, Tom, who does things according to the books, that is, according to the stories about the Mount of Conte Cristo and the other Dumas stories, wants to make it a difficult endeavor to raise the stakes. So he makes a scungeon for Jim, and he makes him work with a pickaxe that he calls a case knife to dig out of a very insecure cabin. So he makes it as difficult as, say, a 30, 60-year enterprise getting out of a rock-formed jail. And in this, what we find is that, though it looks as though he's torturing poor Jim, in effect, he's elevating him to the position of a prisoner. And this, in fact, is the only time in the whole novel when the word right is used on this anniversary of the Bill of Rights, because Tom tells Huck that they can steal things from Aunt Sally and Uncle Silas in order to make this escape for their prisoner happen. And Huck worries about this, and he says, no, don't worry about it. It's the right of the prisoner to be able to escape out of his situation, which also puts another twist on rights in the novel.
I think it's interesting that they make Jim carve different things on this grindstone.
Yes.
And one of them is, here, hopeless and friendless, after 37 years of bitter captivity, perished a noble stranger, natural son of Louis XIV.
There you go. There you go. It's such a rich novel, and really meant to be read by adults and children. The associations with the Exodus story, what could be more elevating than to cast the whole story of two escapees, one who's escaping from his feral father, from Pap, which is, of course, Huck, and the other, the escaped slave who was about to be sold down the river by his owner, Miss Watson. So these two escapees are, in a sense, as we know from the beginning of the novel, at various turns, like Moses in the bulrushes. We know from that opening scene where Mrs. Douglas, Widow Douglas, calls, associates Tom with Moses in the bulrushes, that classic American association, as classic as when the Pilgrims came over, is being reconstituted in the South by Twain. By the end of the novel, it's not so much Huck, who's a work in progress taken into civilization, which is like Egypt, really, according to Huck. He hates it. Right? But it's Jim, who seems to be a figure of the Israelites. And that's kind of complicated, but as they're trying to escape, young Tom's scheme works pretty well until Tom, catches himself on a splinter on a fence, and the whole town who is chasing them are using their guns, and the young man gets hit, and he gets hit in the calf, and then our friend Jim is part of the work of the doctor whom Huck secures to help his friend. And while that doctor is trying to save Tom, he talks to himself about how he can't do it. He can't save the boy. And Jim, who's been hiding and does not want to make himself seen because that will mean he'll lose his liberty, comes out of the bulrushes, comes to the doctor and says, "Let me help you," which basically means he's giving his life for Tom. And as he explains, if it took 40 years, he would stay there with Tom to help him. And so we think of the Israelites being delayed by the worship of the calf, the 40 years in the wilderness. Now Jim becomes the figure who's freed, who is beloved, is the chosen one, as the Israelites were to Yahweh.
Now, what effect did this novel have on the American conscience?
Oh, my. Well, the New Englanders thought it was inappropriate for young people to read because of some of the scenes, which, as you know, Jim, are difficult, and the kind of scenes that you wouldn't want a young boy to encounter in his life. So it was banned in many libraries. Others just complained that it could never, ever measure up to the difficulties of the Negro, and therefore it was not in keeping with the dignity of the Negro, and so on. But it was resurrected there for a number of years until the civil rights movement. In the wake of that, in the 80s, in the 90s, it was banned from the reading lists of high school children because of the word N-I-G-G-E-R. And it took Toni Morrison and other black scholars to insist that, in fact, the language was not racist, but it was showing the reality of the South and elevating Jim and exposing the divided heart and mind of Huck, and in fact, that it was moving beyond anything, completely superior to Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was didactic and never could achieve the kind of reality that this novel did. So anyway, it's still a novel under debate, and it's only been because of the intervention of these African-American critics that in most schools it's back into the curriculum.
Well, thank you, Dr. Arbery, but you know, we're in big trouble because Mr. Twain specifically wrote, quote, "Notice, persons attempting to find a motive in this narrative will be prosecuted. Persons attempting to find a moral in it will be banished, and persons attempting to find a plot in it will be shot." Thanks so much.
You are so welcome.
What then is the end, object, or purpose of humane letters, wrote American philosopher Russell Kirk? Why, the expression of the moral imagination, or to put this truth in a more familiar phrase, the end of great books is ethical. to teach us what it means to be genuinely human. It's that end at which Wyoming Catholic College aims as our students study Homer, Virgil, Dante, Dostoevsky, Mark Twain, and other great authors. In the great books, Self-Evident Truths About Freedom, Conscience, Human Dignity, A Life Well Lived, and Rights become clear and root themselves in our moral imaginations. That is, it's through poetry and stories, rather than through what Kirk called direct moral didacticism, that our way of viewing the world and our fellow human beings changes. Mark Twain certainly understood this, and in The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, perhaps we can find an example and inspiration as to how to use story to change our lives and the lives of those around us. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.